Well, good morning, everyone. I will say it's much cooler up here today than it was yesterday at this time, for whatever reason. We'll go ahead and start off our class this morning. Today we're going into the study of Solomon and the great temple celebration that we have recorded for us in 1 Kings chapter 8. And you might also keep your finger in the parallel account in 2 Chronicles chapter 6. Verse 7 and 8. We'll be going back and forth in these two through the majority of our words this morning. And then, as you can well assume, we'll be going into the book of Ezekiel, chapter 40 through 44, 45. So that's where we'll be studying this morning. So just for a little review, let's open our Bibles back to Psalm 24 and go over the psalm that we've kind of been reiterating as we start our class this week. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. For he hath founded it upon the seas, and established it upon the floods. Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, and nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive the blessing from the Lord, righteousness from the God of his salvation. So today what we're focusing on is the visions that we've seen, or not visions, but the expression here that we see, the description of this great temple that Solomon, along with the help of some of the surrounding nations, and of course the help of Yahweh, in order to build. 1 Kings chapter 8, let's turn over there and read a few verses to get this in our mind. We've been focusing on some important celebrations as we talked about the establishment of the tabernacle in the wilderness and how that was such an incredible event to take place in such a desolate place. And then we also talked about David in bringing the ark back to Zion, or into the city there, into Jerusalem that is, and how important and elaborate that celebration was. And we see the same thing here, only we're in this progression we see a lot more types and shadows that involve what we see relative to the kingdom age and how this affects that glorious celebration that will take place at the beginning of the millennium. 1 Kings chapter 8, then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers and of the children of Israel, unto King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is in Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon, at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord, and the tabernacle of the congregation, and all the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle, even those did the priests and the Levites bring up. Verse 5, and King Solomon, all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him, were with him before the ark, and sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. And the priests brought in the ark of the covenant of the Lord into his place, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread forth their two wings, over the place of the ark, and the cherubim covered the ark, and the staves thereof above. And they drew out the staves, that the ends of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle, and they were not seen without, and there they are unto this day. There was nothing in the ark save the two stones, the two tablets of stones, which Moses put there at Oreb, when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord. And then spake Solomon, the Lord said that he would dwell in the thick darkness. I have surely built thee an house to dwell in, and a settled place for thee to abide forever. We'll stop there with the account as we kind of go back and look at what transpired here. As we said, the parallel account is in 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verses 7, chapter 6, chapter 7, and chapter 8, which has a little bit more detail that we'll refer back to as we go through. But we see that this chapter 8 of 1 Kings brings us up to the dedication of this temple and the order of events with the king and all the congregation as they proceeded with the ark to this temple mount, as we see in verse 5. Sorry, I got behind on my slides here. We see this procession as they bring it up, the ark, and to the temple mount. Zion is further down the hill, as we see in this description. The temple area was further to the north on a higher elevation, and they bring the ark up out of the city of David, as is mentioned. And the fact that we're given so much detail in this account, of the very month here, is an indication of the magnitude of this particular event in Israel's history. If we look at 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, we're given these details regarding the building and the dedication of the temple. If you'd like to turn over and follow there just for a second. 1 Kings 6, verse 1. And it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziph, which is the second month that he began to build the house of the Lord. So we have this detail mentioned here. We're given the year and the date, the specific month here, that is, concerning the beginning of the building of this house. Then in verse 38, we have the final verse where we're given the specific detail of the month of its completion. And that states that in the 11th year, in the month Bul, which is the 8th month, was the house finished throughout all the parts thereof, and according to the fashion of it, so he was 7 years in building it. So 7 years in the construction of this magnificent building. Now back to Kings chapter 8, we're given the specific timing of its dedication, where it says, "And all of the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the 7th month." So, in all, we have the month that the building began, the month that it was finished, and the month that it was dedicated. The month and the years haven't been mentioned in this kind of detail since the children of Israel came out of Egypt in the days of the Exodus. So specific detail of timing and month have been mentioned because, as we stated, this was a significant point, an epoch, in the center of Israel's history, in the history of Yahweh's people. And this was the building and the dedication of this temple, the center of true and specific worship that was instituted once again, but now on a much grander scale. The dedication that's mentioned here in chapter 8 is said to take place in this 7th month, as we've seen. And this would be what we know then as we study this is the 12th year. So we see in this then a full 11 months after its completion that this dedication ceremony began to take place. And it's no wonder we see that the greatness of this occasion requires a tremendous amount of planning. There would be the organization of the singers and the musicians, the feasts and the offerings, as well as the priests and their order of conduct before the people and the king. So they took this period of time to organize all these different parts into a service of dedication that would result in a national observance of the greatness of Yahweh and their precious opportunity to serve and glorify His holy name. Let's go back over that just for a moment. We see that the first was the organization of the singers and the musicians. Isn't this what we've discussed so far when we talked about how this is an integral part of their worship and praise, the singers and the musicians, as they ministered before the Ark of the Lord? We have the feasts and the offerings, the actual sacrificial offerings that took place to show this dedication, this solemn assembly. As well, then, we see the priests and the order of their conduct. Remember, we talked about the priesthood that was established. And so they took this period of time to organize this in seeing and understanding this wonderful opportunity. So then as we continue in this 1 Kings 8, chapter verse 3 and 4, we see that all that was involved so far, who and when this all took place. But we see here then that in these verses as well, there was two entirely different processions on this one specific day. Two processions that were occurring simultaneously. We have the Ark of the Covenant that was coming up from the city of David from the south. But we have the tabernacle of the congregation, which came from Gibeon, which was in the north. So all the holy vessels of the tabernacle were in Gibeon, as we studied about in our other previous class. And they had to be brought down to the temple. And so we see two different processions that day. One came winding down from the heights of Gibeon, from the north, down to the temple. This was articles such as the holy vessels, the brazen altar, the lampstand, the table of showbread. And then up from the south, from the city of David, came the ark, which David had secured earlier in his reign. And so it would seem that the two would come together at some point, of which were not specifically described here. But we know that they would come together somewhere in this temple area. Now, the pictures that I have today, of course, were only limited to a certain artist's impression of what it might look like. But the descriptions herein we see are very similar to what different individuals have come up with. But we see possibly this outer area, this outer court, which isn't equated with the outer court of the sanctuary itself, but this outer area where the people of Israel were able to join together in this larger yard area. Somewhere in this area, the two would come together. Probably somewhere on the eastern side, which is where they would join together and make their way across to the temple sanctuary area itself, and then into it. The ark, of course, was going into the most holy place, and the other vessels were probably installed into the outer area, or outer chambers, known as the chambers of the priests. And we'll look at this in just a moment in 1 Chronicles. These went around the outside, two side areas, and the rear area of Solomon's temple, all of these chambers. And into these store chambers were believed these relics of the tabernacle that were placed there. And because the whole era of Israel's history was brought to a conclusion. And what we mean by that is this whole era of transporting the tabernacle and all of these articles had come to an end. So this is the whole scene that we're placed in, as we see this in 1 Kings 8 and 4. A depiction of the glorious assembly and the view of this inner and outer court of this great, glorious temple. We're told in verse 5 then of how Solomon participated directly with the congregation in this ceremony. And as we read, King Solomon, all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him, were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. Now pause for just a minute and consider the logistics involved with all of the animals, all of the things that would be necessary to make that transpire. What a tremendous undertaking to make this happen. What happened here is the king and the congregation actually entered the temple area before the ark itself. They went in front of the ark. They celebrated the transfer of the ark by the means of the offering sacrifices. Who else do we recall then in our study so far had done the same thing with the spirit of transferring the ark by going before it and offering sacrifices in celebration and even dancing in joy and exuberation? Was it none other than David that we described the other day? David acted in the very same way as the ark was brought up into Jerusalem. And so possibly on this particular occasion, David enacted the particular role of king priest, as we know, and he danced before the Lord, girded in a linen ephod, the symbol of the Melchizedek priesthood. And it seems that Solomon remembered what he had been told of his father, and so there was this deliberate taking up of Solomon now, of the same spirit of this priestly function as he went before the ark celebrating. By the time the ark arrived in the holy place, the king was already there, and so were the people, watching as it transferred in front of them. Over in 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verse 13, again, as we said, this is a parallel in the chapter before us with 1 Kings 8, we see a more detail that's added to this account. We're shown here how the king did something very special then, as this took place. We're told that Solomon, verse 13, that Solomon didn't just stand with the congregation, but he had in fact built a special platform that he had intended. Now in this picture, it's an artist rendering, of course, but that might have possibly been what this artist had in mind, this platform or this scaffolding that was built for him to stand upon. And only here in Chronicles do we have this detail. For Solomon, verse 13, had made a brazen scaffold of 5 cubits long and 5 cubits broad and 3 cubits high, and had it set in the midst of the court, and upon it he stood, and he kneeled down upon his knees before all the congregation of Israel, and spread forth his hands toward heaven. So imagine now the mindset of Solomon as we see him described up on this scaffold, on his knees with his hands toward heaven. We see this temple area, the altar in front of the temple, and then we have this brazen scaffold specially built for Solomon in the midst of this court, but to the east of the altar itself, the east. And again, all of these things should come to our mind as we begin to study in the book of Ezekiel and the vision of that glorious temple in the future age. We're told in Ezekiel 40 of the east gate that the prince would enter through. We believe Solomon had this built. He had this built for this specific reason of leading, becoming the leading position that the king intended to take on this day in offering these sacrifices, this praise, and this glorious worship service. He needed to be seen. He felt he had to be seen by all of the congregation. And so this was built. All of the people then could only be in one place, and that was in these outer courts. And they filled all the outer courts that surrounded the holy place so that they might witness the spectacle of this glorious day. Again, let's try to envision how wonderful that would have been to have seen this transpire. The ark came in through this eastern entrance of the south gate. But before this happened, the congregation had already gathered, as we've mentioned, and the king was already present, and he had ascended up to this brazen scaffold. Here he stood in the front of the temple, and all sides around him and behind him was the entire congregation of Israel in the outer courts. Not only did he want them to see him, but he wanted them to be able to hear specifically the words that he had to say. Again, does this bring it to our mind the psalm that David wrote and presented to Asaph? Not only did he want them to see, but he wanted them to hear, because today, during this wonderful event, the king was to offer this prayer of dedication. And the interesting thing about this chapter as we study here is that on this day of dedication of the temple, we see that this was a day of absolute priestly activity, full of all the priestly things that were to be enacted. But Zadok, the priest, is nowhere to be found. He was among the group that brought in the ark, but he's nowhere in front of the people leading them. And yet, this was a day full of these priestly activities. But it was Solomon that we see became the high priest on this day, and deliberately so, because after the spirit of his father David, who danced before Yahweh, who was girded in this linen ephod, typically of the spirit of this priesthood, Solomon was chosen to do the same. And this brazen scaffold was built, and Solomon, having made his entrance into this temple, was presented before all the people as the acting king priest in dedication of this glorious temple, up on this scaffold, elevated before them for all to see. 1 Kings 8, 6 through 8, and the priest brought in the Ark of the Covenant unto this place, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread forth their 2 wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims covered the ark and the staves thereof. And they drew out the staves. At the end of the staves were seen in the holy place before the oracle. And they were not seen without. And there were they unto this day. And it's interesting how that is mentioned, because this was a very big deal for these to be removed. Remember, all these years, they were never to remove these. Remember the instance of Uzzah that we discussed the other day, and how the ark was supposed to be transported. So this was very important for them to see this. And of course, it's written here in this way that they were there unto this day. So what actually happened was, as the whole congregation stood there, the priests, the Kohathites, that is, came bearing the ark through the eastern side, making their way across the court towards the temple. And as the nation gazed on, they saw the Levites and the priests separating. The Levites stood on one side of the altar, while the priests carried on with the ark into the temple itself. The whole nation, including Solomon, saw the ark disappear through the door, under the porch, into this glorious holy place, and finally coming to rest in this most holy. And it was here in the most holy, or the Holy of Holies, where we see these two giant guardians that awaited to receive the ark. Because inside the holy place were two enormous cherubim that had been built. This is another artist rendering of how large this was. These were so large that their wings outstretched touched both walls on the sides of the holy place. They seemed to be huge, massive. And in studying the way these were built in 1 Kings 6, we see, well, let's turn over there and read that. 1 Kings 6. As he came together and built these. Verse 23, and within the oracle he made two cherubims of olive tree, each 10 cubits high, and 5 cubits was the one wing of the cherub, and the 5 cubits the other wing of the cherub. From the uttermost part of the one wing unto the uttermost part of the other were 10 cubits. And the other cherubim was 10 cubits. Both the cherubim were of one measure and one size. The height of the one cherubim was 10 cubits, and so was it on the other cherubim. So we see this as it outstretched here over the ark. So thinking about the cubit, if you take the 18-inch measurement for a cubit, this would roughly equal 15 feet tall. 15 feet. So Brother Darwin and I were looking in here, and we measured, and these two large cross pieces that hold the braces here, where they come together in the cross there, that's 15 feet tall. So imagine these cherubim being 15 feet tall. Up here above my head, there's a pulley hanging onto a leather rasp here, and that's 15 feet tall. So imagine how massive these were. And this whole room being covered with wood that was overlaid with gold. So just think of the glory, this majesty, we might say, of the impression of such a wonderful place with this massive shining cherubim there in the midst. And so this must have been a breathtaking sight to see, as far as the priests were all concerned. All the while, the nation stood outside and watched. And even King Solomon remained atop his brazen scaffold, patiently waiting to see what would happen as the holy ceremony transpired. We're told in verse 8 of 1 Kings 8, and they drew out the staves, and that's where they were unto this day. And as we mentioned before, the reason they drew these out, because we're given a clue in 1 Chronicles 23, verse 25 and 26, that we find that with the completion and the dedication of this temple, it marked this new era in the history of this nation. The time of absolute rest had now been given. There was no longer a tabernacle that had to be taken down and removed from place to place. This was now to represent a permanent dwelling place for Yahweh among his people. So 1 Chronicles 23, verse 25, for David said, the Lord God of Israel hath given rest unto his people, that they may dwell in Jerusalem forever. And also unto the Levites, that they shall no more carry the tabernacle, nor any vessels of it, for the service thereof. So this truly was fulfilled, well, to a certain extent at this time, as they placed it there on a permanent basis. This symbolized that the journeying days of the ark were now over. And finally, when the priest took it into the Most Holy and removed the staves, it was as if to say, truly, this is the final resting place of the ark, and the priest shall no longer carry it thence. The time of its permanent abode had now come to pass. We can just imagine, then, brethren, the suspense and the excitement in the outer courts as the king stood silent, waiting patiently. And then finally, as we see, the priests came back out. Let's go back to the book of Chronicles just for a minute and see how this transpired. Again, it's in a little bit more detail, but we're told that as the priests withdrew and came out, that the temple choir burst into praises. And it's only in Chronicles do we have this part of the account. 2 Chronicles 5 and 11 has identical opening phrase as 1 Kings, where it says, "And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place," this is 2 Chronicles 5, I'm sorry, "for all the priests that were present were sanctified and did not then wait by course. Also the Levites, which were the singers, all of them of Asaph and of Heman and of Jeduthun, which were their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps, they stood at the east end of the altar, with them 120 priests, sounding with trumpets." 120 trumpets. We've all heard marching bands and ensembles play, but imagine 120 trumpets. "And it came to pass, as these trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Yahweh. And when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and the instruments of music and praised Yahweh, saying, 'For he is good, for his mercy endureth forever,' that then the house was filled with a cloud, even the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of God." So in researching this, they said these words, "Kitab ki le'olam chazdo," meaning, "For he is good and his mercy is endless." Think of this congregation saying these words in such a magnificent way. And think of these very words. These were the words that the psalm contained that David had delivered to Asaph these many generations before. Well, one generation before. And so we see then that they all burst out into praise. We see the two accounts coming together and see that this was truly a glorious occasion. The king as well, all the Levites with all their musical instruments, all waiting outside and standing over between the altar and the king on the east side. They waited with their trumpets and cymbals and harps and the choir. And so they anticipated the priest's return. As soon as they saw them here in the porch again, they burst into praise. But as soon as they began to sing and praise, with Solomon standing behind them on the scaffold, suddenly we're told the enormous thick cloud of darkness came billowing in as a token of the divine presence that had now arrived. And so the divine endorsement, we see, had been given as the ark had been placed in this final resting place. Let's imagine again how Solomon must have felt at this time. He had put so much work and dedication and thought and planning and so much of his heart into making this transpire. And so he was so totally excited at this glorious moment. We again see in 1 Kings 8, you can almost sense the stuttering in his voice and excitement as we read in verses 11 through 13. "Then spake Solomon, 'The Lord said that he would dwell in thick darkness. I have surely built thee an house to dwell in, a settled place for thee to abide in forever.'" Solomon was truly thrilled by what had happened. And let's see what he had done next. In verse 14, "The king turned his face about, and he blessed all the congregation of Israel." All the congregation of Israel stood. The fact that the account tells us that he turned his face tells us that up to this point he had been standing on the brazen scaffold, facing the temple and watching the priests. He sees them come out, and he hears the choir begin to sing. He sees the cloud, and then he turns around now and blesses the congregation. This correlates with what we might find written in Numbers chapter 6, verse 23 through 26. It says, "On this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace." Consider the words of this as we see this glorious event take place. They felt that the Lord's face was shining upon them. They felt that they truly enjoyed peace. And these are probably the words that Solomon spoke as he blessed the people. We're not told exactly at first. But how fitting these would have been at this wonderful moment. And again, let's look at the most glaring fact of this point that we're making here. This in Numbers was the instruction that was given to the priests to bless their people. It was the priest's obligation to bless the nation and not the king. Numbers says, "Speak unto Aaron and his sons." But it is Solomon here who undertakes the work of this occasion. And he stands upon this brazen scaffold, built that way on purpose, for him to be able to be seen and heard by the entire congregation. He's taking up the whole function of the priesthood deliberately on this day and no other. So then after Solomon had blessed the people, and as they stood up from kneeling before the thick cloud of the presence of Yahweh, then he now turned back again towards the temple, as we see, and began in prayer and supplication unto Yahweh. Solomon bent down on his knees. He spread his hands upward toward heaven, and we're told in verse 22 and verse 54, he was there with his knees on his knees and his hands in the air. And again, we need to imagine the feeling of Solomon on this occasion. Wouldn't this be similar to what will happen in the future? This is the pattern of how the people and their king acknowledge the presence of deity and his majesty. Can you imagine this, brothers and sisters, on a worldwide scale? The people here have witnessed the ark coming into the place. They have seen the thick cloud of the presence of Yahweh. The king has turned around and blessed the congregation, and now he's about to offer this formal prayer of dedication. Again, we see that Solomon is so moved at the spirit of what is happening that he drops to his knees. And can we imagine him on top of this scaffold? He collapses to his knees and he begins in prayer with his hands out to heaven. He's probably oblivious now to everything else that's around him. He's completely dialed in, we might say, focusing on his prayer to Yahweh, the God of heaven, concerning this moment which was the climax of Solomon's life, in terms of what he was going to accomplish. Again, think of all that's been accomplished and how this was this type of the greater Solomon who will establish his house in the tops of the mountains. We'll talk about that in a moment, but let's go back to this prayer in a little bit of detail just to kind of get the feel of what he's saying. We can see that this is broken up into three main sections. The introductory section, which starts in verse 23 and goes through verse 30. And the theme of these verses seems to be the praise of Yahweh, whose dwelling place is in heaven. We see in verse 30 a key which is seen throughout the prayer, where he says, "But God will indeed dwell on the earth. Behold, the heaven and the heavens of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house that I have builded. Yet thou have respect unto the prayer of thy servant and to his supplication. O Lord, my God, to hearken unto the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prayeth before thee to this day, that thine eyes may be opened toward this house night and day, even toward the place which thou hast said, My name shall be there, that thou mayest hearken unto the prayer which thy servant shall make toward this place. And hearken thou to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel, when they shall pray toward this place, and hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and when thou hearest, forgive. So we see from just this short portion of this prayer that Solomon acknowledges that Yahweh dwells in heaven. The heavens of heavens can't contain him, much less this house that he has builded. He wasn't deceived by the grandeur and the splendor of this building. He knew that whatever the greatness was that they had accomplished on this day, that Yahweh, the God of Israel, dwells in heaven, as he always has done, and always will do. And so it was to heaven that he addressed this prayer, although he acknowledged gratefully the symbol of his divine presence there among them, placed in the temple in the form of this thick cloud. And what Solomon now did was to pray for everything that he could think of. Every aspect of life for the Israelite was brought to their attention. That Yahweh may judge in disputes, that he may help the nation recover from defeat in battle, that in time of distress he might bless them with rain and also restore them from the afflictions of plagues and sickness, and restore them of times of war and have compassion on them in their captivity. Solomon brought together here a prayer of petition, whereby he asks for divine favor in everything, every possible circumstance that might befall the nation. They were truly God's people, and he was dwelling among them. Solomon now gives a sense of focus to the nation. They were now to direct their prayers to the God of the present, who dwelt in the Holy of Holies, but who really dwells in heaven. There seems to be something very well, very planned, and very organized about this prayer and this dedication of Solomon. We notice the part that he mentions about the stranger here in the midst of them in verse 41 and 42 of 1 Kings 8. He says, "Moreover, concerning a stranger that is not of thy people Israel, but cometh out of a far country for thy name's sake, for they shall hear of thy great name, and of thy strong hand, and of thy stretched out arm, when he shall come and pray toward this house." So again, we think of how this is fulfilled in the future age, how all nations, people, and tongue will come, as Isaiah 2 mentions. And think of how this is fulfilled with the Gentiles of all nations, peoples, coming to worship here, giving praise to the King of creation and the Lord Jesus Christ. There was no Jewish exclusiveness here then to what Solomon was saying here today. It was his desire that all nations might be enfolded into this loving embrace of the God of heaven. He is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance, and that all should worship and obey him. And so finally, in the prayer of Solomon, he pleads that Yahweh might always remember his people throughout all their failings, all of their trials, which he knew they would submit to, that they must trust in God, and that he would never turn his back on them. In the final section, we might call it, we have written for us in the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 6, verse 40 and 42, if you'd like to follow along. Right at the end of the prayer, we're given more detail that is only given here in the book of Chronicles. It says, verse 40, "Now, mine ail, let, I beseech thee, thine eyes be open, and let thine ears be attent unto the prayer that is made in this place. Now, therefore, arise, O Yahweh, into the resting place, thou and the ark of thy strength. Let thy priests, O Yahweh, be clothed with salvation. And let thy saints rejoice in goodness. O Yahweh El, turn not away thy face of thine anointed." He speaks about the priests, the saints, and his anointed, and Yahweh remembering each and every one of them. Now again, where do these words come from? Or maybe we should say, where else do we find these words? Well, if we turn to Psalm 132, it's one of the songs of decrees. There's been a few sisters that have mentioned this to me this week. One of the psalms that was brought into the decrees of Hezekiah And yet we find these words coming out of the mouth of Solomon. Isn't that an interesting fact? Who wrote the Psalms or Psalm 132? Well, most say that this was David, as it was a psalm for bringing up the ark into Zion. We have the words here in verse 8 and 9 of Psalm 132 that says, "Arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest. Thou art the ark of thy strength. Let thy priests be clothed with righteousness, and let the saints shout for joy. For thy servant David's sake, turn not away the face of thine anointed." Then we have the answer of Yahweh we see in Psalm 132, verse 13 and 14. He says, "For the Lord hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation." Then in verse 14, "This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it." What a wonderful, appropriate psalm for Solomon to use. It was undoubtedly written concerning the removing of the ark and placing it in its final resting place, for David foresaw the time when this glorious temple would house the ark as it became this final glorious resting place. That's an interesting note as we consider this Psalm 132. How he mentions the horn of David, Solomon, to bud or to sprout and branch. This also brings to our attention the verses in Zechariah 6, the branch that would build the temple. We'll turn to this here in just a moment. But we see how this, again, fits together with exactly what was prophesied of the branch of this family. Not only David and his throne, and not Solomon, but the greater seed, the greater Solomon of this family established, who will build this house. The word crown in Psalm 132, verse 18, is the word used to describe the priestly crown that went on the top of the high priest's mitre. Exodus 29, verse 6. And it's used of this high priest's crown. And so the answer of this prayer in response to Solomon saying, "Arise unto thy rest, thou ark of thy strength." We might see the divine response comes back as, I will do that. And yes, I have chosen Zion. Yes, I will clothe her priests with salvation. Yes, I will cause the horn of David to sprout. And upon his head shall be the priestly crown which shall flourish. And this is the day when the priestly crown was to flourish upon the head of Solomon. As we look forward to that day when the priestly crown shall flourish on the head of our Lord Jesus Christ. So again, how appropriate it was for Solomon to quote these words of Psalm 132 as he brings this magnificent prayer to a conclusion, kneeling down on the brazen scaffold that he had built for the city, for everyone to see him on that glorious day. And only in Chronicles it gives us this account of what happens after Solomon concludes his prayer. Chronicles chapter 7, 2 Chronicles 7, verses 1 through 3. We're almost out of time. But now when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of Yahweh filled the house, and the priests could not enter the house of Yahweh because of the glory of Baal that had filled the house. And when all the children of Israel saw how the fire came down and the glory of Baal upon the house, they bowed themselves with their faces to the ground upon the pavement and worshipped and praised Yahweh, saying, "For he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." Again, as we referred to earlier, the very words given to Asaph by David. Can we just see this sight on that day? As the king brings his prayer to a conclusion, almost overcome with emotion, sinking into his knees with his hands stretched up towards heaven, the outpouring of the thoughts of his heart and the words from his own earthly father, suddenly there was this enormous flash of fire. The presence of the glory of Yahweh shone all around, and the whole congregation bowed down their faces to the ground, awestruck at the sight of the divine presence. What a tremendous spirit among them that day. And how would we feel if we were as Solomon? It's our hope and our prayer that we at some point can be included in this wonderful congregation that will be able to enjoy the same similar tremendous spirit that's among them in the future. The fact that Yahweh had answered their prayer in such a way showed how pleased He was with the events of that particular day. 2 Chronicles 7, verse 4 tells us, "Then the king and all the people offered sacrifices before the Lord." And it was a wonderful, highly spiritual occasion then that we see that the highlight of Solomon's work had come together, the culmination of this point. Back now in 1 Kings 8, we're told in the latter verses of the chapter how the ceremony was then brought to an end. In verse 55, we see Solomon actually bless the congregation a second time. Thought I was there, 1 Kings 8. Sorry. Verse 54 and 55. "And he stood and blessed all the congregation of Israel with a loud voice, saying, Blessed be the Lord that hath given rest unto his people Israel, according to all that he promised. There hath not failed one word of all of his good promise, which he promised by the hand of Moses, his servant." Then finally in verse 65, he tells us, "And at that time Solomon held a feast, and all Israel with him." What feast would this be? What celebration in particular would be offered now? Do we have an idea? Is there something that comes to our mind of what feast would be celebrated on this particular day? Again, we had a clue when they told us the month and the year of this celebration. Since it was the seventh month, this must have been the Feast of Tabernacles. But the Feast of Tabernacles was celebrated every year. And on this occasion, this Feast of Tabernacles held a very special significance. They had observed the 7 days for the dedication of the temple. This was the first 7 days. And now they were offering the Feast of Tabernacles a second 7 day period. So what an appropriate celebration to observe the Feast of Tabernacles on this day. The Feast of Tabernacles celebrated an original thing that, originally what it celebrated was that it was a time when God cared for His people as they dwelt in tents in the wilderness. But now on this special day, there was a temple built for Yahweh and all the holy articles, and it now stood there in all its permanent glory. If ever there was a sign of divine blessing resting upon this nation, it stood in the form of this glorious temple and the worship of Yahweh that was instituted therein. The Feast of Tabernacles was celebrated also to give thanks to Yahweh for the final ingathering of all the harvest at the end of each year. It celebrates the time when the Gentiles would be gathered into the Abrahamic fold. So which feast will be held under the auspice of the king priest in the age to come? Well, we're told in Zechariah, "It shall come to pass that everyone that is left of the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." The answer, of course, after the type of Solomon here. Another one that would refer us to this is Zechariah 8, but we're out of time for that. So just as Solomon brought his own service of dedication to an end with the observance of the feast, so also Christ, as the King Priest in the age to come, will require all the nations to come up and assemble before Him to worship and to pray during this Feast of Tabernacles ceremony in the kingdom age. This is not only mentioned in Zechariah 8 and 14, but as we said earlier, our train of thought can't help but go to Ezekiel. Ezekiel's chapter 40 through 45 depict this great, wonderful temple vision that Ezekiel was allowed to see. They tell us what would happen. And so to summarize the study of what Solomon has accomplished this day, we see everything that he has done had been enacted as the role of king priest. He had assembled the heads of the nations for the ceremony, and it was the king who accompanied the ark in its journey to Zion. It was the king who bestowed the blessings on the congregation. It was the king who presents the prayer of dedication. It was the king who leads the nation in the offering of the sacrifices. It's the king who consecrates the middle of the court so that the offering may be made. And it was the king who celebrates the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll have to stop there. We've run out of time. Tomorrow we'll pick up with a little more of this vision and the hope that we have of this glorious future.